This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hi there, this is Alex. In last week's Radio EcoShock program, I surprised listeners with a very different point of view. Former whole earther Stuart Brand came out swinging for nuclear power, genetic engineering, and geoengineering as the new green. I'll reply in just a minute. Our main speaker this week is a refreshing antidote to Brand. David Corton was recorded at the University of British Columbia. He's a well-traveled specialist in the economy and cultural systems, author of the book When Corporations Rule the World, and many others. Corton has a much better idea, in my opinion. We'll finish up with an example of corporate concentration, the functions that Stuart Brand says are inevitable. This time, it's our enslavement of animals in concentrated animal feedlot operations. There's a set of two new books out, and we'll talk with editor Daniel Imhoff. What is the matter with Stuart Brand? I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. There are so many holes and howlers in former whole earther Stuart Brand greened, anti-green position, it's hard to know where to start. I am still formulating my reply based on his online book, his conversation that I recorded, including another 32 minutes not yet played but offered by download, and his speech the same night at the University of British Columbia, which is online now. Here is one exchange we had at that conversation I recorded in Vancouver on October 5th, 2010. Alex Smith. The argument could be made that you see the answer to the climate being rectified by technology, or one might say, more human hubris. More technology and more hubris. We can see how that has fouled up so badly so far.
We haven't fouled up so badly. Come on. You don't like your cell phone?
How can Brand say we haven't fouled up so badly right after warning us that climate change may drive us to extinction? Things aren't so bad? Or this exchange where I ask Brand to explain his former self as a self-sufficiency communal sort of guy versus his present big money boosterism. He belittles the question, of course. Alex Smith, you started out with the back to the land, putting out a book for people to be self-supportive. In those days of the Whole Earth Catalog, that's where I came to know you, but you've moved completely away from that.
No, I haven't at all.
I haven't heard anything about that. I haven't heard about chickens. We haven't learned about how to grow your own food.
Engineered chickens with even more nutrition in them and more melodious clucks. That is coming, not by any large corporation. People are going to do that in their backyard, or chickens that sing like canaries.
In fact, as we hear in the Radio EcoShock interview on concentrated animal feedlot operations, chickens have been mutilated by big business. They are shut in cages with no movement and no light, cannot walk, have their beaks clipped off. Not much singing like canaries in that corporate design. Later, evaluating the 1970s, where he was the champion, Brand finds that, quote,
AIDS may have been one outcome of the sexual promiscuousness. Certainly a lot of case of crabs disguised as a revolution is how one person described the 60s.
Sexual diseases were the only outcome of the sexual revolution, Stuart? Remember when you were supposed to marry a virgin and then find out if the sexual chemistry worked? Should everyone have stayed in their closets? Oh, please. People don't need to bother going back to growing their own food. The country, Brand tells us, is a place to be shunned, left by most of humanity, left to the wilds of nature, and we presume the factory farms that are feeding all those city folk. Really, it was a sad verdict on the old Stuart Brand, rather than a whole generation. The Stuart Brand many knew and loved is dead, replaced by the new green businessman who tells us we are gods. We should push risky technology until we make it, or go extinct trying. Then Stuart Brand goes into an appreciation of the multi-billionaires acting where governments are gridlocked, men such as Andrew Carnegie, who founded so many libraries.
Rockefeller Foundation, I know one of the mid-level Rockefellers, and they've been an astounding dynasty, not only of wonderful people generation after generation, but really smart philanthropy generation after generation.
He missed the source of that great Rockefeller wealth, monopolistic oil, the climate toxin. Apparently, he has not read another appreciation of the Rockefellers, the book Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon, Nelson Rockefeller and the Evangelism in the Age of Oil, written by Gerard Colby. A good Baptist Christian tale of not-so-wonderful people taking over the lands of other people. And what about the dark history of David Rockefeller's Citigroup? All those petrodollars and narco dollars recycled, the espionage and intrigue, were they all wonderful people? The Rockefeller Brothers' philanthropy has indeed helped some environmental causes, including donations to the Great Bear Rainforest Campaign. But did you see their renunciation of fossil fuels and their giant campaign to save the climate of the Earth? Neither did I. Brand tries to appear like a person very plugged in. He goes to important meetings. He's just back from one in Washington, D.C. Billionaires are his friends. He has become an apologist for this system, which is eating the earth, the sky, and the ocean. His idol Warren Buffett, held out as an example of true capitalism in the recorded conversation, could make a sincere change, namely, stop hauling endless train loads of coal out of the West to the Midwest power plants using his train company. No sign of that. In an earlier Radio EcoShock piece, I already covered Warren Buffett's non-statements about the coming climate crisis. Richard Branson could denounce senseless travel on super-polluting airplanes on Virgin Airlines and his exotic travel destinations. He has not renounced his bread and butter, but dabbles in space tourism as well, as though the atmospheric damaging hobby is what the world needs now. Bill Gates has been extremely slow to the global climate change table just emerging this year and has produced nothing there yet except an idea for a new type of traveling wave nuclear reactor, something in the long-distant future. None of these charitable billionaires seems able to keep up with the darker side of money, people like the notorious Koch brothers who are sabotaging both national politics and climate change action. We can hardly talk about all the other multi-billionaires around the world, the Russians, Chinese, Arabs, Indians, and so on. What are their beneficial intentions? Where are they on climate change, except solidly on the wrong side, condemning our children to heat, floods, and rising seas? Most are holding on hard to their fortunes, jewels, and power. All the solutions assume the capitalist financial system will survive, fortunes of the beneficent wealthy will remain intact, and will fly higher, ever higher, into becoming the gods of technology. I think the system is bankrupt, and I am not alone. This is part of a continuing plea that governments are useless, so his friends, the multimillionaires and billionaires, should step in and take private action. Brand almost threatens that these individuals may step in with geoengineering. They have the money. It only takes $300 million a year, he says. And Stuart Brand is meeting with other very rich people from the Silicon Valley to independently fund research into human cooling of the planet by injecting more pollution. Who will geoengineer the planet? In Brand's speech to the UBC students, the same night he flew by the idea of ocean acidification coming out of geoengineering, admitting it was a drawback. The plan isn't perfect, but still necessary, he says. Brand does a disservice by minimizing this risk, but then he minimizes all risks, even the most hair-raising things like nuclear waste, dirty bombs, and wild genetic engineering done by the general public to create more pleasant chickens, I suppose. I was almost at a loss to explain my complex take on Stuart Brand as a social phenomenon. He claims to be green, but a new kind of green, that denounces all the greens before him, especially Greenpeace. He laments regulation, even environmental regulation, as an impediment to free invention in business. That sounds so familiar, like the Cato Institute. He's a kind of green anti-environmentalist who renounces even his former self as an explorer, back to the land, self-sufficiency, all that. The billionaires will get into a big league to save us. That seems naive to me, to say the least. And can we wait for the saviors while doing little ourselves to change this culture of death? At the end of his speech to the University of British Columbia staff and students, Stuart Brand said, "This is a whatever-it-takes deal, folks. We may not get out of this century alive." But, he says, it's all still a great adventure. Meanwhile, the nuclear power push is moot in the United States. Brand didn't tell his students that the fossil fuel industry has stalled any big nuclear construction until decades later to help us avert the catastrophe. It's too late. Even the huge international plans will likely founder on the coming depression's destruction of capital. Most will never be built. So why is Stuart Brand still flogging dead nuclear power as a solution in the United States? Brand is certainly now representing himself as a friend and apologist for some American and British billionaires and other movers and shakers. he became a pollinator from the counterculture to the business world, and in my opinion, became a kind of character to inspire one's dinner table conversation or corporate meeting. It's harsh, but that's my take. As such, Stuart Brand serves a purpose in his public talks, to elucidate what the response or non-response of some English-speaking wealthy man is. Listen to him, because you will hear the progressive capitalist buzz. Surprise, surprise, all it takes is more technology and more big business, and it will be run by the very rich. Brand said he didn't see much difference between governments and corporations. They're just different ways of organizing people. I see a big difference, don't you? There are giant holes in Brand's simplifications. Some of his statements in the afternoon were preposterous. Nature is what we make of it. We are gods. We just need to improve a little. There is nothing wrong with technology. We just need a lot more of it. We can fix every mistake. Everyone will be performing genetic experiments in their garden sheds. If some horrible form results, we'll find it and exterminate it with some other life form, as if one can take such mistakes back. He sees the genetic game to be like computer hacking. Mistakes just make the system stronger. Try taking back life forms like rabbits in Australia, zebra mussels in the Great Lakes, and all the invasive species we already introduce. Now try to correct the superbug created in a university lab contest. I could go on. I don't classify Brand as a climate denier. He is a true believer, the most desperate, and still manages to profit from both the corporate world and the crisis in his own way. He is a businessman. As an idea pollinator moving between some powerful money and some bright minds, Stuart Brand does bring us some fresh perspectives. He can roll out the California hype like few others. I recommend listening to him to see what one big money line is these days. I disagree with Brand's hubris and his ideas. In fact, now that I have met him, I don't like Stuart Brand, and I felt he didn't like me. Brand made it apparent that we, as a small audience, had failed him that afternoon. I asked him if he would like an MP3 of the recording. He replied, "No, there's nothing there I have not heard before, many times." He is so great, and we so small. Likely, we don't know any billionaires at all. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. We go now to a new talk by author David Corton. His books, When Corporations Rule the World and The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community, have set the pace. His latest book is Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. It couldn't come at a better time. This new talk was recorded September 27, 2010, by the presenters, the UBC Reed Sustainability Program.
Now, I'm assuming that you're all here because you are quite familiar with the fact that as a species, we are in deep trouble. Is everybody on board with that? So I don't intend to get into a lot of detail and statistics about how bad our situation is. I assume you already know about that. I'm going to focus on trying to provide some frameworks to take us into a deeper understanding of why we're in that problem and what it means for what we need to do. And I'll warn you that my approach, my take on the situation, is that we have to change virtually everything. That we have to fundamentally reinvent our cultures and our institutions, at least particularly our modern cultures and our institutions, and particularly the institutions of the economy. Now, I know this is part of a series, and you're going to have another speaker who I gather is working on the premise that we can fix all these problems with some clever technologies. I take strong exception to that view. I mean, it's a nice idea if we could do it with technological fixes, but to me, if you really understand the nature of why things are going so badly wrong, it takes you into a recognition of how badly our institutional and cultural frameworks are serving us. Now, all of this can be terribly depressing unless you put it in this context, that we humans are creation's experiment in reflective consciousness. We are part of a much deeper evolutionary process by which life has evolved toward ever greater complexity and consciousness. We are a species with a reflective consciousness that gives us a capacity to to choose our future with conscious collective intent. You're of a generation that's grown up with the information technologies that allow us to come together as a species and to make decisions as a collective whole in a way that has never been possible before. And what advantage of drawing in a few older folks like myself, having lived through that transition, we can see much more clearly the implications of what a profound shift this is that you folks, most of you folks, grew up with and take for granted. Now, to understand where I'm coming from, I think it is necessary to understand a bit of my background. I grew up a little south of here, down in the United States, in the state of Washington, a town called Longview. You just go straight south about, I don't know, from here maybe 300 miles or so. A very white community, very non-culturally diverse. You know, I grew up in a monoculture. The most exotic people that I knew was my aunt, who was a Catholic. And there was a rumor that my grandmother voted Democratic occasionally. Anyhow, I assumed that's where I would spend my life. I went off to college to prepare to come back and run the family business. And, you know, one of the very few ways that my formal education affected me was I happened to take a course in my senior year outside of my major field on modern revolution. And I learned about these communist revolutions that were a threat to our American way of life. And that was one of these fundamental changes in life. I decided instead of going back to my hometown, I would spend my life working overseas and in regions of Asia, Africa, Latin America, bringing to them the secrets of American business and economic success so they could become happy consumers like us and forget all this revolution nonsense. That was quite a dramatic shift. And, of course, that threw me into a totally different life in which I was deeply immersed for 30 years of working in international development, living 21 years outside of my own country, immersed in the diversity of cultures of Africa, Latin America, and Asia, on this mission to modernize and bring prosperity to the world. Now, I'm kind of a slow learner. It took me something like 30 years to figure out that what we were trying to do was not only not working, but it was having disastrous consequences for most people. That, you know, a few people, of course, were getting very rich, but most people were getting deeper and deeper into desperation. We could see the deterioration in the environment, in the forests, and the fisheries, and the rivers, and the lakes. And I spent 15 years in Asia, which is a region that I particularly love because of the deep, rich culture and the traditions of strong family and community. You saw those cultures being torn apart, families broken up, communities broken up. I began to turn, well, actually, another piece is you need to know is in the earlier stages of this, you know, I went to business school, got an MBA and PhD from the Stanford Business School, taught for a time at the Harvard Business School. So I'm coming all at this all from a business school background, and very much an establishment background. And one of the things that I valued about my business school education was that we learned to think about organizational systems. Now, of course, in business school, and you know, this is a subject I taught at the Harvard Business School, but of course, what we're teaching is teaching the students how to organize a corporation. You know, organize the culture and the incentive systems, authority systems, information feedback, all the different aspects of the organization, in order to shape the behavior of those people that worked in the organization to keep focused on the bottom line and maximize the corporation's profits. Now, I was kind of in the field that that Charles was in, and many of us had this this idea that, well, you can make people more productive if you can get them really working together effectively in teams, and that's really good for the people, and it's also good for the company because they can generate more profits as a result of that. That's a whole different story. But the key point here is that since I talk a lot about the economy, a lot of people think of me as an economist, refer to me as an economist. it's actually not technically accurate. My field is organizational systems. And it's very key to understanding how I think about economic relationships, because I'm not looking at pricing systems and so forth. I'm looking at institutions and culture and how those shape the behavior, not just of people in corporations, but in terms of shaping the behavior of whole societies. So it is a deeply systemic perspective. And out of my international work, I came to the point of, okay, let's figure out, you know, as I began to realize what was happening in terms of the devastation in the world, I came to realize the same things I was seeing in Asia and other places I work, the so-called underdeveloped countries, that those same things were playing out in those countries that we considered to be the models of development. Canada, United States, Europe, Japan, that they were all moving toward more and more people in desperation, increasing poverty, cultural breakdown, environmental destruction. So you begin to realize, wow, this is truly systemic. And you start looking at what does this tell us about how we are organizing as a species, how we're organizing as modern societies, and what can we do about it? And it was out of that inquiry that led to writing When Corporations Rule the World. That was the first cut at laying out my analysis of what's really going on with this global system, and particularly the organization around these powerful institutions of global corporations that are designed to maximize financial profits at all costs. And I want to say a little bit more about money. You know, this is really interesting. This is part of what I came to realizing, that absolutely foundational to understanding this whole system is money. Is money. You know, back in 1992, I got together with a number of non-governmental organizational leaders in Asia. I had just moved from the Philippines back to the United States, but I went back to the Philippines for this little gathering, very small gathering. We spent 10 days together reflecting on the Asian development experience. And what did it tell us about what these civil society organizations and non-governmental organizations needed to do? And we started talking about the experience of development moving out and destroying communities and villages, colonizing the land, converting it into taking over the resources that people depended on for their livelihoods, and turning it into corporate property, and then essentially turning the people that used to live off of those resources into serfs working for corporations. You know, a recreation of serfdom, of colonialism, of a pattern that I eventually realized has dominated human affairs for 5,000 years, but that's another big story. But in terms of this meeting in the Philippines in Baguio, mountain resort, we began to get this image, this money. It's like money moving out across the countryside, absorbing and destroying life every place it touches. Have any of you ever seen that? This is a really old movie, but the old horror movie, The Blob, that was the image that came to mind. This undifferentiated ball of protoplasm, whatever life it touches, it just absorbs into itself. And I thought, that's really curious. How could that be? What is this thing called money? What gives it this power? Isn't it just a number? How could it have a motive drive? How could it be inherently life-destructive and evil? That's my definition of evil, that which is destructive of life. And I struggled with this for days with the group, and we talked about this. And eventually we realized money, of course, has no motive energy. The only energy is our human energy, our life energy, that has become deflected and distorted and misdirected by our obsession with money. I've come to think of it almost as a cultural trance, and it is so extraordinary as you think about it, because it is nothing but a number created with an accounting entry. You know, I wrote the book When Corporations Rule the World, but the truth is, you ready for this? The accountants run the world. Accountants run the world. I saw someplace that some of the highest paid business graduates in their first jobs are those that go into accounting with the Wall Street firms. And as you think about it, it makes perfect sense, because all those games going on Wall Street, they call, financial innovation, is nothing but creative accounting. most of it fraudulent, misrepresentative. But that's where the money is in playing these accounting games. So it makes a lot of sense that accountants would be in great demand on Wall Street. Anyhow, you come back and you begin to think about money. Where does it come from? Who decides who gets it? And you think about, we have moved over a very long period of time from societies that once had no money, no equivalent of money. It's also interesting, if you study biology and living systems, there is no equivalent of money in a natural system. But we've gone from societies where relationships were based purely on caring relationships, or non-caring relationships, one or the other, but they were not mediated by money, to a situation where in modern societies, particularly right now, virtually everything we do as an individual depends on money. And more of our relationships are mediated by money, to the exclusion, in many instances, of caring. And yet we never step back and ask the question, wow, doesn't that give incredible power to those people who are in a position to create money and decide who gets it? Control that power, and you control society. Now, I'd be willing to bet that this is an idea that none of you have heard in any of your classes in the university. I certainly didn't learn about this in the university, which in itself is really interesting. Where money moves determines the fate of nations, determines who eats and who doesn't, who has a place of shelter, who has no place to go. You have enough money, you have access to everything. You have no money, you have access to virtually nothing in our modern society. And yet nowhere do we discuss it in these terms. This tells us something about the state of our society, and including the state of our intellectual systems, the state of economics as a discipline, and the state of our universities. But this is part of the much larger conversation that we have to come to a deeper understanding of what's happening to our world. Very simple terms. All familiar with the financial crash back the end of 2008, which I gather didn't hit quite as hard here in Canada as it did in the United States. I understand you also have felt the effects of it. Now you step back and you realize what that was really about.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock. We'll continue with David Corton. He talks about origins of money and its impact on our society.